One of the most compelling aspects of Torah is the notion of a living Torah, Toras Chayim, that we can access Torah and relate to Torah in a way which is germane and relevant to us. That while the Torah itself is immutable and unchanging, Jews have always found those touch points and those conduits, avenues of relationship to make Torah their own. We have studied together throughout our journey here in the Book of Devarim that this is the notion, the big picture theme of Sefer Devarim, which is called Mishnah Torah, a second Torah. The Jewish people are reaccepting the Torah of Har Sinai in a fashion which will relate to them as they undergo this transition, entering the land of Israel, entering Eretz Yisrael, leaving the previous milieu of life in the desert, a very different setting. Well, now they need a new acceptance of Torah, a new avenue of contact to Torah, and that is the second presentation of Torah. It is as though in this Chumash, in this book of Devarim, the Torah is modeling for us living Torah, the ability to re-access Torah and own it for ourselves. Well, this second Torah comes to a head, concretizes in our parsha, Parshas Kisavo. After the parsha completes the narrative of particular mitzvos, which begun in the previous parshios, it then concludes with overarching statements of commitment on the Jewish people's part. It sets up the ceremony of Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal, two mountaintops that when the Jewish people will enter the land, they will affirm their commitment to all the above stated mitzvos by accepting blessings and curses for obedience or disobedience. And then the parsha continues with another narrative of consequences for obedience or disobedience of the above stated mitzvos. The blessings and rebuke narrative, bracha and tochacha narrative, which concludes explicitly and clearly with the statement that this narrative concludes the second covenant, the second bris, the bris of Mishnah Torah. Have a look. In the final pasuk of that narrative, it says as follows. Eile divrei habris. These are the words of the covenant, asher tziva Hashem es Moshe, which Hashem commanded Moshe, lichros es b'nei Yisrael, to seal with the Jewish people, Be'eretz Moav, here in the land of Moav, Milvad Habris, in addition to the previous covenant, Asher Karasi Tam B'Chorev, which had already been sealed at Chorev, i.e. Sinai, Har Sinai, here there is a second covenant taking form, i.e. our Parsha is concluding the entire Mishnah Torah of the previous Parshios. And there's really a symmetry and an aesthetic to this setup that Parshas Kisavo, with its narrative of blessings and rebuke, concretizes the second covenant as the Jewish people are about to enter the land. Because when you go back to the first covenant, the covenant of Har Sinai, you will see that it ends the same way. The Torah tells us at the end of the book of Vayikra in Parshas Bechukosai that there are blessings and rebukes which conclude that experience, the Sinai experience, before the Jewish people move on to other destinations in the desert. So here you have it, like two peas in the pod. Just like the covenant of Har Sinai ends with blessings and rebuke, likewise, the second giving of the Torah, the covenant here of Sefer Devarim, of the Book of Devarim, concludes with blessings and rebuke here in this week's parsha. Neat clear, and we can begin to own this notion of a second receiving of Torah, re-accessing Torah in a way which is relevant to the new generation entering the land. We can really begin to own this here in this week's parasha, where it's taking final shape and form. Let's see if we can flesh out the picture a bit more. I am convinced that the symmetry between the first covenant, the first giving of Torah at Har Sinai, and this second giving of Torah here in Sefer Dvarim is even more profound and poignant. Can we suggest as follows? That when our parasha tells us that when the Jewish people enter the land, they will commit themselves to Torah through blessings and curses proclaimed at two mountains, Har Gerizim, Har Eval, that is actually the mirroring image of Har Sinai. That just as the first time around, the covenant in the desert was established at a mountainside where the Jewish people made statements of commitment, here where they enter the land and they once again proclaim statements of commitment at a mountainside, there is this poignant scene of taking Torah once again in a mirroring sort of way, mountainside commitment once again, but again in a fashion which reflects their new setting, mountaintops, not in the desert like Har Sinai, but here in the land, their new station for accepting Torah. What do you think? This is not compelling within itself, the fact that once again they are committing to Torah at a mountainside. Well, when we dig deeper in our parasha, and in particular that narrative of Mount Gerizim and Mount Eval, the blessings and the curses, you will notice countless textual clues and echoes which ring back to the Har Sinai narrative of Parshiyos Yisro and Mishpatim. Have a look and think if this is compelling to you. For starters, our Parsha tells us that at these two mountains, the Jewish people are supposed to assemble stones, a stone monument, consisting of actually 12 stones, as we're later taught in the book of Yeshua. Tekimas Havanim, plus Uvanisa Sham Mizbeach, builds an altar. Well, hold on. Is that not exactly what happened at Har Sinai? There is both an altar built, Vayivan Amasam Mizbeach, Tachas Ahar, Ushti Masri Matseva, and again a 12-stone monument. There you have it, pristine and precise. And now we read further. The Torah tells us regarding building this altar at the two mountainsides, Har Gerizim, Har Eval, in the land of Israel. The Torah tells us, Lo sanaf aleihem barzel, do not wield iron, raise a blade to cut the stones. Well, that is exactly what it happens to say in the Parshas Yisro narrative following Matan Torah, that when you build a stone altar, Lo sivnas hem gazas ki charbacha hinafta eileha, do not wield a sword upon stones. Just so happens to utilize the same language and concept in the sister narrative. And then we scroll on. Here at Har Gerizim, Har Eval, there are varying karbanos offerings which were brought. Valisa lav olos v'zavachta shlamim, burnt offerings and we slaughter peace offerings. Well, that is exactly what was sacrificed as Har Sinai, as expressed in that narrative. Vayalu olos v'yizbechu zavachim shlamim. And then we notice a final clue, that at Har Gerizim, Har Eval, at those mountains, the Kohanim are supposed to tell the Jewish people, Hayom Hazani Yesalah, on this day you're becoming a people, which is read by the sages to mean this day, really every day we can re-access Torah. Well, that very same expression and midrashic derivation appears in the Har Sinai narrative. Bayom Hazeh, on that day, same language, which means Shiudivri Torah Chadashim Alecha Kilo Hayom Nitna, Torah should be new to you every day as though it was given that day. Do you see it? Powerful. This day, same verbiage, same lesson of a new Torah, which remains relevant after each respective covenant, the covenant of Har Sinai and the covenant here of Sefer Dvarim at Har Gerizim, Har Eval. compelling. That, as with every textual pattern, while you can quibble with me regarding each particular parallelism, is it compelling, is it not? The sum total of so many textual clues echoing between the two narratives threads together a wide, beautiful tapestry, really portraying our picture that at Hargrizim Harevel, at these mountainsides, they are reaccepting Torah in a sister Har Sinai of sorts, because in fact, the second receiving of Torah, Mishnah Torah, is no less important, is no less significant. We must don Torah for ourselves as we're entering the land. Beautiful. Well, now let's consider what some of the new realities in Jewish consciousness are at this transition point as we're entering the land, as we're no longer the wandering Jews of the desert, but now citizens of who possess our own territory, Eretz Yisrael, and consider what that yields, what that causes. What is this new approach to Torah which this people with their new identity entering the land needs? How are they different? And how is that reflected in the second receiving of Torah? So, we've discussed in the past the profound contrast between the Jewish people in the desert and the Jewish people entering the land in terms of dependence versus independence. The wandering Jews in the desert were largely dependent, i.e. cared for. Hashem provided all of their needs. Manna fell in the morning to feed them. They were provided with well water. And they were provided not only with physical sustenance, but spiritual sustenance as well. They had an open line of communication to the divine through Moshe at all times. They were living Torah. Their story is the evolving story of Torah. The book and divine direction is being written to them. Hashem is leading them by the hand morally and providing for them physically. Well, all of that changes when they enter the land. In the land, there is no more manna. We have to earn our own keep, each man upon his plot of land, farm his land. There is no longer a Moshe with an open line of communication. Rather, we need to take the Torah of the previous era and each of us apply it with good personal judgment. Ooh, what is the halacha of the Torah derived from the book of Torah as it ought to relate to my life? What are the moral messages and hashkafa of the Torah as it ought to relate to my life? That, do you see this pattern of a transition from dependence to independence and personal judgment and autonomy as they're entering the land? Well, that is what this new acceptance of Torah is all about, owning Torah for themselves and taking responsibility for it. I posit that that is reflected by the language in this week's parasha, when the Jewish people are to stand at the mountainsides and reaccept Torah. Have a look. It says as follows. It says, V'chasavtas ha'avarmim, as called divrei ha'Torah ha'zos, you're to write on the stones the Torah scroll, but not in the precise same fashion that Moshe wrote the Torah scroll in the desert, but rather be'er heitev, with a clear commentary or translation. Ooh, that now the original Torah is to assume translation, assume commentary. What is a commentary or a translation? A commentary or a translation is to serve the needs of the reader. The original Torah is perfect, but the reader needs a commentary or a translation so he or she can understand Torah, so he or she can find a means to relate to the original text. Of course, this is true of all commentaries until this very day. You will notice that there are so many hundreds, thousands of Jewish commentators and commentaries who are each finding a relevant message for their era in that same Torah. Well, that is always what a commentary is, as in accessing the Torah to the people in their generation, because the people themselves need to relate to Torah. Well, that is what's going on here as the Jewish people are entering the land. It's insufficient to simply read the Torah scroll of the desert where Hashem speaks in his terms, but now they need to find their terms, a translation, a commentary and explanation as they are to intuit the Torah here when they enter the land. What do you think? Are we making too much of this expression? I ask my skeptics in the peanut gallery, are we making too much of this commentary explanation imperative that it truly represents the new reality of the second Torah given in the book of Dvarim? Well, have a look. You will see that this term, be'er, explanation commentary, is not a freestanding explanation, but it is actually a neon color phrase which brightly shines across Sefer Dvarim and captures his message. Because you probably recall that Sefer Dvarim began its narrative with that same expression, be'er commentary. It says, Hoa Moshe be'eres ha-Torah hazos. Moshe began to explain the Torah, to give a commentary or a translation to Torah. That is what the narrative of Dvarim is about from its get-go, and that is what's concretizing here at the formal pact or covenant thereof, at the mountainsides of Hargreaves and Harevel in the land, clear textual pattern, and as we're calling it, neon color phrase, bulging from the text in both of these passages. And I think we can truly begin to feel proud and take ownership of our understanding here, what the second Torah is all about. But I want to pull the thread, expand the thread further. You know, whenever you're on the verge of a Torah discovery, the clues are abound. You notice a few clues, and then the rest of the clues begin to surface all over, like any good mystery, detective sleuthing. Well, I would like to posit that if we revisit our comparison between the first covenant of the desert, which was sealed at Har Sinai, Mount Sinai, versus this scene, when the Jewish people are going to concretize a covenant at the mountainside of Hargreaves Harevel, we will see the pronounced distinction, how this is a new covenant of Torah as it relates to the people themselves, the people who must find their own relationship to Torah because it is their Torah from which they will have to make decisions, as opposed to the Torah of divine legislation dependency in the desert. So let's think here. Let's think about the various contrasts or points of distinction which stand out between the ceremony of accepting Torah at Mount Gerizim and Harevel versus the original at Har Sinai. We'll see how they all reflect this theme splendidly and consistently. Number one, the question of who's doing the talking? Who's the orator? Who spoke at each respective assemblage, Har Sinai versus here at Hargreaves and Harevel? Well, at Har Sinai, it was Hashem speaking. He proclaimed the Ten Commandments. At Hargreaves and Harevel, there was no divine intervention prophecy. The people proclaimed the blessings and the curses. Don't you hear a profound transition here? We declare the statement, the new Ten Commandments, as it were, in the form of blessings and curses, because it is our Torah. Interesting. And let's consider another difference. That is the who's on top, who's on bottom. What do I mean by that? Who's on top of the mountain and who's on bottom of the mountain? Well, you recall at Har Sinai, it was the leadership on top of the mountain. Hashem on the mountain, Hashem Shechin on the mountain, and Moshe and Aaron and the elders ascended up the mountain. The rank and file of the Jewish people stood at the bottom of the mountain. Well, you will see in the text in our parasha that the inverse happens at Hargreaves and Harevel. that actually the Kohanim, the Levim, the leaders of the Jewish people, together with the Ur and the Ark, stand at the foot of the mountains. The rank and file, the regular tribes, go to the top of the mountain. What do you think that stimulating inverse represents? It is as though the text here is impressing us, provoking us. Turn the tables here, who's on top, who's on bottom, rank and file or leadership. Well, don't you hear? That is exactly the point of the transition going on here. The rank and file now ascends the top of the mountain and assume center stage. Take the baton from the leadership, because that is what this new Torah is all about. Taking ownership, each individual Jew or Jewess, taking ownership. It is my Torah, which I will have to apply. Now let's continue to study some of the differences between these two mountainside commitments, Har Sinai versus here, Har Gerizim, Har Ebal. Another distinction. At Har Sinai, there were 10 commandments, legislations from Hashem, do's and don'ts. Well, very interesting. Here at Har Gerizim, Har Ebal, there is not legislation, there's not statements of do's and don'ts, but rather statements of consequences, blessings and curses. If you behave, you will be blessed. If you don't behave, you will be cursed. Well, there's a very poignant distinction therein. When Hashem is talking to the Jewish people in the desert, and they are simply on the receiving end, he tells them do's and don'ts. Thou shall not, in a didactic, absolute way, because in a Hashem-centered process, of course, the focus is on the lawgiver, and there is no thought of the recipient disobeying. But here where the Jewish people are taking possession for the Torah, believe it or not, we human beings, do think deviant thoughts at times. Should I do it or should I not? Ooh, I can rebel. I have free choice. I have free will. And we have to face the consequences. But hold on. You know, if I behave, I will be the beneficiary of blessings. If I misbehave, I will be on the receiving end of curses, God forbid. Ooh, and we have to make that distinction. Do you see how it's very much of a human consciousness orientation, which is what this verse is all about? Hashem is saying, yes, I want you to take possession of the Torah in your mode of thinking as a human being. I will face the consequences of my decisions for accepting or not accepting the original commandments of Har Sinai. And let's continue with some additional distinctions between the two. Well, the Ten Commandments of Har Sinai were all set as one group, Ten Commandments. On one mountain. However, here at Har Gerizim and Har Ebal, there were two distinct mountains, one for blessings, one for curses, segmenting the two, blessings and curses, good and bad. Well, what do you think is that the significance of this distinction of leaving behind a modality of cohesiveness, unification, 10 commandments in one line, and now bifurcating two mountains, two groupings, blessings, curses, good versus evil? Well, this is again a very, really a divine versus human distinction. Hashem is one, his will is one, and there's really no room to distinguish between good and evil, positive and negative, blessings and curses, 10 straight commandments. However, we human beings, we struggle with conundrums and tensions and dichotomies, conflicts of good and evil, and we need these two distinct mountains, a mountain of good, a mountain of evil, mountain of blessing, mountain of curses, and those two roads, the road to Eden and the road to hell, as it were, represented here. And finally, to note one final distinction, the number of statements set in each respective station, right? At Har Sinai, there were 10 commandments. Now, 10 is a cohesive number of the divine. Kabbalah teaches that 10 is a number of unification, reflecting divine unity. Hashem is one, and therefore there are 10 individual commandments which come together as a collective unit of 10. However, how large is the grouping of blessings and curses here at Har Gerizim and Har Ebal? Well, Rashi points out there are 11. There ought to have been 12, perhaps, two corresponds to 12 tribes, it was limited to 11 because one of the tribes is not represented here, and that is the tribe of Shimon. Well, do you see how the number here is not the divine number of 10, but a number corresponding to the tribes, the people themselves? It is their Torah contoured to them. So bingo, there you have it. We traced five distinctions between the two mountainside covenants, Har Sinai versus here at Har Gerizim Har Eval, right? Just to review, number one, we traced the distinction of who's doing the talking, God or man. Number two, the question of the leadership or the rank and file, who's on top, who's on bottom, right? Number three, we trace the distinction of, is it legislation, do's and don'ts, thou shalt not, or is it blessings and curses or consequences? Number four, we trace the difference of, is it one solid line and mountain with one grouping of mitzvos, or is it two mountains, good and evil bifurcated? And number five, we trace the distinction, is the number 10, or is it 11/12 reflecting God or the people? There you have it, how all the differences between Har Gerizim and Har Eval are actually symptomatic of one core distinction between the two stations for covenant, and reflect this larger theme which we have traced today, how the Torah of Har Sinai, which is a divine Torah, is now becoming a Torah of commentary as the people are going to relate to that perfect Torah and apply it. And it requires their perspective and their assuming ownership and responsibility thereof. Beautiful. And as I think about this issue and theme which we're discussing, the dependent or prior dependent taking responsibility, I can't help but think of the parent-child relationship. As a father of young children, oftentimes think about the various stations or milestones in the journey of maturation as the parent cedes more and more autonomy and control to the child. So ultimately, we want the child. We don't want them to hold on to the purse strings or the umbilical cord, so to speak. We want them to assume responsibility for themselves, but they're not ready yet. It's a gradual process. And you know, there's always this concern that as you cede control, autonomy to the child's not going to come through. The child's going to have their own ideas, rebel even. So if we are correct that that is what's going on here, it's that sort of transition going on here in the second Torah culminating in our parsha, a Torah which will be owned by the people, then I would suggest the tension, the suspicion, that maybe there will be deviation, maybe there'll be rebellion, probably looms front and center. Well, you actually find this in the final statement of our parasha. Have a look. The final pasuk in our parasha says as follows. The final statement in the blessing narrative of our parasha. It says as follows. It says, "Vilusasur mikol hadvarim asher anochi mitzav eschem hayom yom minosel." Don't veer from what I'm telling you, right or left. Well, I posit that as front and center to the blessing narrative of our parasha and the narrative of our parasha at large, concretizing the second covenant. Don't veer right or left. You want to go in this direction. You want to go to the right and overdo it. You'll want to go in this direction, to the left, and under to it, right? You'll want to be firmer and more religious than the mitzvah. You'll want to be less religious. No. Do exactly what you are told. That is a relevant and germane issue here reflected by this pasuk. What do you think? And I'm again calling out to my skeptics in the peanut gallery. I love skeptics. The learning process is, of course, based on skepticism. And I welcome healthy skepticism as opposed to, God forbid, unhealthy skepticism and cynicism of the learning process. What do you think? Am I making too much of this expression in our parasha, the losasir, don't veer right or left? Well, you will find that this expression is again what I call a neon color bright phrase, which bulges and illuminates throughout the text, because it is not limited to here in Parshas Kisavo. It is a phraseology, do not veer right or left, which is reiterated throughout Sefer Dvarim and beyond as the Jewish people enter the land. Right here you have it, for example, earlier when the Jewish people might struggle with accepting the authority of the Sanhedrin, Lo Sasim and Atavashidu Chayam and Osmol, do not veer right or left from what they tell you. You find the Jewish king who might have ideas of his own, he's told same expression, Ul Vilti Surman Amitzvim and Osmol, he may not veer right or left. And then you have in real time when the Jewish people on the lines in the book of Yehoshua, the same exact unmistakable echoing expression, Al Tasser Mimenu Yom Nesmol, do not fear from the Torah right or left. So there we have it. We have not only traced a textual pattern beginning with a verse in this week's Parsha, but appreciated why it is an overarching theme of this entering the land / second Torah. Jewish people are taking Torah for themselves, and they might have some scary ideas, some deviant ideas. No, there is a trust here. You are not going to veer away from it in either direction. And when we consider that really this fear of ceding control to the prior dependent who's now coming independent, and I think out of child rearing, there's another fear or stigma. And that is on the part of the child. And that is, I have to make my own decisions. Something very comforting when I don't need to do that. I just trust my parents, my mentors. There's something very comforting about that. I think about the child when they have their first mishap on a job, or they have their first mishap, a road accident or the like, and it's no longer pull out your cell phone, call mom or pop. Now you got to handle it. Now, that's a big deal. But again, an opportunity for growth. Well, I would like to suggest that if we are understanding the theme of the Second Covenant culminating in our parasha correctly, we have some of that sort of issue. The issue of everything which you've learned till now in the theoretical, now you're going to have to apply and use good judgment. Now, what is good judgment called in Hebrew? Right? In the vernacular, we say seichel. Good judgment, not simply chachma, book wisdom, but seichel, good judgment. That is how the grammarians explain the word seichel. It means practical judgment. And that is what a child has to learn as they assume adulthood. Everything they learned in the theoretical, now they're going to have to execute it. Well, you will find this very expression, seichel, in the final verse in this week's parasha. Laman taskilu. Torah will ensure that you have practical judgment. For the first time, that notion appears here. Well, no coincidence, because the second covenant of personal responsibility is concretizing. Again, I'm calling out to the peanut gallery. Am I making too much of this final verse in our parasha and what it signifies? Well, notice an unmistakable textual echo. Again, when we consult the opening to the book of Yehoshua, and the Jewish people are actually entering the land, it says that very same expression, an unmistakable deja vu and reverberation. For us Haskell through Garden Torah of practical judgment, no coincidence at all when we appreciate that Torah must, all parts of Tanakh must be read in an integrative fashion, following the touch points and linkages between each other. Yes, seichel, practical judgment, and the need to now apply it for yourself. Everything you learned in the book, everything you learned at home or in school, that is what this second covenant transition is all about. Beautiful. Here we have it, child rearing and maturation with all of its challenges, the expectation that the child will eventually embrace their mission and won't drop the ball and could be trusted, and as we started with, and in turn, the mandate for the child to execute everything which they learned in a judicious, smart way. It's all right here. But wouldn't it be awesome and great and validating if beyond these strands, textual strands, which we're pulling and stitching together and weaving together in a tapestry, we would just find very blatant in the text that our parsha, in articulating the second covenant here, finishes explicitly with this exact message. That it says, you know, until now you were in the pupil chair, You were seeing, you were internalizing things, but it wasn't really you yet. Now it's becoming you. Now you're in a place, now you have mature. Wouldn't it be great and awesome if the text says that explicitly? And it does. Of course it does. Have a look right here at the final message in this week's parasha, and the final passage in this week's parasha. The beautiful language of the parasha, it says as follows. Atam Yisem, it's called Asher Asa Hashem Yinechem Baritz Mitzrayim. You know, from day one, you saw all divine revelation, everything which happened in Egypt and beyond. However, V'lunasen Hashem L'cham Lev L'das, Hashem didn't give you a heart to really understand. V'inayim L'roz V'aznayim L'shmo, eyes to see, ears to hear, all the perceptions, all the tools of perception, Adayom is that till now. It's only 40 years after the Exodus, here at the time of the Second Covenant, where you could take everything you saw from day one and really appreciate it and do something with it. And the sages see this statement as a statement of maturation. They say sometimes it takes 40 years until the pupil or the child or the student understands what they're meant to, what their Rebbe was telling them. You know, at the moment, al das rabu, at our pom shana. Well, the Jewish people were in that pupil's chair from the days of Egypt, and only now are they mature. Well, here you got it. It's really splendid, and it's beautiful. And again, very applicable in terms of child rearing and human development. And the sages draw that correlation explicitly. Rashi links this teaching about the 40 years until the Jewish people had to develop, had the ability to develop internalization, the ability to appreciate what they learned and applied. Rashi in Maseches Avos connects that to the teaching therein in Avos. Ben Arbom Labina, it's only at age 40, true maturation in a person's life, when they have Bina, the ability to extrapolate, the ability to fully appreciate that which they learned and do things with it and apply it further. I trust I will appreciate that when I get there as a 40-year-old. But you hear how our parsha's theme is seen really as maturation. There you have it right there in the text. You know, I think about sometimes that whenever you have a document, you need the signature at the end of the document. Yeah. Well, when you have a parsha and you posit with varying proofs that there's a certain parsha theme, the final narrative ought to validate it, right? Well, here you have it. Our parsha ends with the signature, large, a John Hancock signature, as it were. Right here explicit in the text, this is a parsha all about maturation, which is what the Second Covenant is all, concretizing here is all about, taking everything which you learned, and now 40 years later, as a mature 40-year-old who no longer is holding on to the purse strings, you're financially independent, hopefully, the apron strings, the umbilical cord, and I really hope some of these millennials who are still dependent on mom and dad get it together by age 40. We'll have to continue to assess the sociology of that one, but you get the point. The text does it beautifully here. You see the beauty of Torah and really the aesthetic, the divine artistry of a parsha, how it's coming together in all of its clues. And I would like to find this idea fleshed out further in Midrash. You know, whenever there is a parsha theme, you will find how Midrashim, which might not be fully appreciated, or might seem random or haphazard, or you'll see that they're actually somehow capturing that theme. Well, look at how the Midrash cited by Rashi explains our parsha's finale, when Hashem says, "You didn't have eyes to see, a heart to understand until now, 40 years later." So it says as follows, the following episode. It says, you know what happened? When Moshe, before he died, handed the Torah scroll to the tribe of Levi, they protect the integrity of the text, the Masoretic text, the Jewish people actually came forward and fetched and complained. Yeah, we Jews Jews tend to do this rather well, but here it was a welcome complaint. They said, hold on, you're giving the Torah scroll to your tribe of Levi. They're going to say one day, Torah's only theirs. We're not real Jews. They'll just disenfranchise us that we're less than. And Moshe said, well, I'm so impressed with that so-called complaint. Now I see you really got it. This is what it means that now 40 years later, you just finally got it. Well, what is so significant about this scene and complaint to the Jewish people? Oh, one day the Levim are going to say it's only their Torah. Well, don't you see so many dimensions of maturation and taking responsibility for Torah porn out here? Number one, the Jewish people are not simply passive children. Oh, whatever you say. No, they're coming forward. They're staking a claim. They're expressing themselves. And number two, they're expressing themselves in what way? They're expressing themselves concerning their stake in Torah and insisting that they not be disenfranchised. Later, number three, you will see they're anticipating an event in the future, that maybe in years to come, the tribe of Levi will misinterpret their possession of the Torah scroll in a fashion to disenfranchise the rest of the Jewish people. Right? That sort of forward thinking, that's responsibility. And I say that as a father of young children, the ability to consider consequences and implications. That's real mature thinking. And here you have on so many levels a delicious manifestation of taking responsibility. And that is what Midrashim always do, capturing the larger theme of the text. Here you have it splendidly, beautifully. And I would actually go so far as to suggest that for all the beauty of childhood, a child is, may I say, a human in training. And the Jewish people in the desert are a nation in training. That while it might be very comforting to have direct communication with Hashem in the desert telling you everything to do, it is only when we struggle with our own decisions and sometimes make the wrong decisions and will suffer the curses, unfortunately, and the consequences, but it's only when we're taking that responsibility that we are really full participants in the covenant. So in a certain sense, if I may be so bold, the ultimate covenant of Torah is not the covenant of Sinai of Shavuot, of the holiday of Shavuot, but actually the covenant spelled out here in our parsha when the Jewish people are entering the land and accepting at Hargreaves and Arivot these two mountain-sized a second Torah. Well, is that bold of me to suggest that this is, in a sense, the real Matan Torah, the real giving of Torah, Har Sinai was simply a training? Well, you will actually notice the text, our parsha, is provocative in that way. It says expressions such as, Hayom Hazani Yeslam, you're only becoming a people today at the end of the 40 years. Yeah, you weren't a people at Har Sinai. It says expressions like, Hayom Ani Mitzavcha, I'm only commanding you in mitzvahs today. It's as though you really weren't commanded in mitzvahs before in the desert. And you'll actually see that this expression, it's only today you're commanded, only today you're becoming a people, is laced throughout our parashas. Again, what I call one of those neon color phrases, which just bulge and project from the text. Look at this. Again and again in this week's parasha, right? I count, I don't know, 10, 12 times you have such statements here. Today you have become a people. Today you are commanded. Hayom azah, yom. It's today you're becoming subjects of Hashem. Again and again and again and again and again. Well, there you have it. The text is highlighting for us true Torah commitment lays an ownership and responsibility. True humanhood lays in ownership and responsibility. There are challenges to adult maturation, but yet that's where the real opportunities lie. Let's all welcome assuming our own stakes in Torah, our own stakeholding shares in the Torah. That this Torah of our ancestors ought to become our Torah. each personalized by us as it relates to us. Now, this is a theme not only in Torah, but in general culture as well, Lahavdil. I think of the adage of the great German author and philosopher Goethe when he said, what you inherit from your father first must be owned by you in order, you must first own it to take possession of it. And how true of Torah, we have this glorious heritage, this glorious Mesorah of Torah from our previous generations, from our ancestors, but we each must find a way to personalize the Torah for ourselves. Well, that is not some newfangled notion, but actually modeled in the Torah itself here in Parashas Kisavo, culminating the second Torah, the Mishnah Torah, and it is being repersonalized and re-embraced by the new generation in their terms. Thank you very much.